excellent for the introduction. Okay. I've been at Rogers Clem for about 10 years, and a majority of that time has been spent working on with auto dealerships. We have a good book of business, you know, in Central California and in LA, or Southern California region, working on dealerships in terms of audits, reviews, tax returns, 401ks, their property tax returns. So our company handles it all. So as Alin said, I was going to talk to you guys about schedule review, fixed assets, and retention records. And so I'm approaching this as I am, as an outside accountant that comes in and we'll look at the books, you know, obviously most likely at year end, but we, some of our clients, we do quarterly work for them. So I have the, so the objectives will be to gain an understanding of what we typically look for on a schedule. I'll give general, general procedures that we look for, and then I will delve a little bit deeper into every section of the balance sheet that usually has is a scheduled account, and then we'll touch base on the fixed assets and then review some retention requirements. So I by no means claim that I'm an expert when it comes to retention requirements. There is a schedule that is in this list of DMV requirements, and it goes into great detail about the time frames that documents should be held. And so I'll give you guys that for you guys to have. So with that, let's delve into, and then please feel free to ask me any questions on any of the topics, especially like when it comes to the fixed assets. That's going to be some general information, some tips that I have. And then, but if you guys have any questions at any time, please let me know. So looking at schedule review, in general, your outside CPA is probably reviewing the schedules for aged items. And that's going to be anywhere from 30 days old, and the controls aging 30 days up to 90 days. And that depends on the type of account, and more specifically, the receivable, whether it's going to be the 30 or 90 days. And I'll go into more detail about that. We look for credit balances, and that's usually obviously on the asset side of the balance sheet that we focus our attention on. And then we will always inquire about large balances. And that's really going to be regardless of age, regardless of whether it's a debit or a credit balance. We're just going to want to make sure if it's a large receivable that it was collected, and if it was a large payable that it was paid. And that's just, I always get, especially on a schedule that might have, I can see a handful of control numbers that have smaller balances, and then I see one that has a really large balance. That always leaps out at me, and I want to make sure everything's okay with that. And then we always look for misposting between control numbers, and that is a pretty good indication that there's a lack of schedule review on of that schedule, of that account. If your CPA is doing tax return work, then they're not, I can guarantee you that they're not really going to be looking at any of the income statement accounts. I know some of those schedules, some of those accounts are scheduled, but they're not going to look at it. We will do more of a comparison, a year over year comparison, to see if an account is up or down, and maybe ask a question. You might come across when an asset account is, like for example, a receivable is actually ends up being a credit at month end. And I know some of the factories won't allow you to submit your financials if you have a credit balance in that account. And so that would be a case that you would want to be reclassing that over to a liability account to park it there temporarily. And then immediately, then you would submit your financials, and then you would be reversing that the following month. And I bring this up because I've had a client who has, I believe it was their sublet account, that was actually coming to a credit at month end, and her response was to actually wipe that balance off and write it to the cost of goods sold, which is definitely not something you'd want to do. Those balances are still valid and you would want them to clear through their natural process and not just be writing them off and then they go off into la la land. Well, no one will be able to follow up with them. When it comes to the schedules at month end, in my mind, your AP, your AR, or your DMV clerk should be printing out the schedules or, you know, typing up notes on the PDF and giving the business manager the status of any of the aged amounts so you are aware of what's going on in case you need to make somebody else aware of a finance manager or the owner needs to be aware. And then a general comment when it comes to the reconciliations, you know, after you do a reconciliation, I always like to, you know, step back and ask myself, does the reconciliation make sense in terms of the aged items, you know, in terms of aged checks, deposits in transit, and any differences that may be arising in the credit card batches in terms compared to what the bank received. And, you know, if it's the credit card, it might be just bank fees, credit card fees that you need to record in order to get that amount to clear the bank. You know, if it's an aged check, is it actually still outstanding? Could be the potential that it's an employee is stealing the money, you know, and they're just masking it. And then same thing with deposits in transit. So just kind of stepping back and looking at the aged items of a reconciliation. Okay, so now I wanted to kind of delve into the different types of the balance sheet accounts and give a little bit more detail of what I would look for in the schedule. So one of my favorite accounts is the cash clearing account. And I say that because of the volume that could be sitting in that. And I know not every cash clearing account is scheduled, but ideally it would zero out at the end of the day. More realistically, it could take 1 to 3 days, you know, depending on if it's a weekend. But anything over 5 days is definitely going to be a concern to me, considering it should have been put into the bank, deposited into the bank that Monday if we were talking a weekend. So any of those amounts should be concerned. And so I kind of scattered some stories that I've seen myself and like Patty that Chris has seen in his history. So for example, this dealership, they had made the switch from Reynolds and Reynolds to Automate in 2020, right as the pandemic was setting in. And so they actually didn't get the best of training after this transition took place. And so in the past, the cash clearing account had always been zero at year end. So it never caught my attention. However, at the end of 2020, two of their cash clearing accounts had ballooned to $6,300 and $18,000. And so I do quarterly work for them. And come the first quarter of 2021, I delved a little bit deeper into those accounts and the balance was still hovering at $9,000 and $14,000 in these accounts. And it turned out that the AR employee was stealing from the company, was stealing some of the deposits. And so, you know, that some of that's on me. I should have asked the question at year end, like, hey, why is this balance so high? You know, but then a combination of the business manager not reviewing the detail at all to see that some amounts were getting hung up and not clearing in a timely manner. And that's going to be, you know, with these stories, that's going to be kind of the theme is coming down and reviewing the detail and asking questions on aged items. So in terms of the receivables, the contracts in transit, you know, could be as quick as 5 days if it's perhaps coming from the factory's financing arm, you know, maybe longer if it's coming from a different bank. Typically, anything over 30 days is where I'm going to start getting concerned on a contract and making sure that that is a valid receivable and there's not anything that is unusual about that. The same thing with vehicle receivables. And in terms of the down payment, you know, ideally that would be collected at the time of vehicle delivery and, you know, following up after 30 days, especially if the down payment is shown on the contract as paid, well, it's a little bit harder for the dealership to argue that they got the money, that they didn't get the money, when the contract states that they did receive the money. So that's why you want to stay on top of those and make sure those get collected in a timely manner. And then I know it's the case that with customer deposits, which I know is, you know, shot up ever since the pandemic, that those would be perhaps put to a vehicle receivable, which I don't really recommend that. I would recommend that a liability account be set up, and but map to the same schedule as your CITs and your vehicle receivables. That way you can still see them in the same schedule. You don't lose track of them. I know you don't want to lose track of them at the end of the day, but really, since that's a credit balance, it actually should be sitting on the liability side of the balance sheet, but still mapped to that same schedule. When it comes to the wholesales, that's, again, we're going to focus on 30 days asking what's going on. I know the DMVs have been slower with titles and getting that information to in a more timely manner, which can cause it to drag out to 60 to 90 days. So I know that's kind of changed the amount of days that it would take to get that clear. And then turning to parts and service along with some of the factory accounts. So parts and service, we typically 60 days is getting a concern, you know, 90 days is when we're starting to ask, and then 30 days for factory amounts. And I know I say 30 days, but I know some of the accounts, some of the funds from the factory, like for incentive money, is paid quarterly. So I know that can obviously take up to 90 days before it gets paid. You know, at 120 days, in our minds, that charged customers' accounts should be frozen if they're not paying timely. And then the age credits, if they have no activity, if that customer is not doing business with you, in my mind, that money should be returned back to the customer. I know those tend to sit there on the balance or on the schedule, but if you think that there's no real chance that customer's coming back anytime soon, then, you know, if the service manager would say, yeah, just go ahead and return that money back to them, you know. In terms of the factory accounts, we look for credits just to see if there are potential chargebacks or missed postings. Or it could be the case that incentive money was set up for the wrong amount, in which case maybe the process needs to be reviewed with the sales or the F&I department to determine what's causing that issue so that it doesn't happen on a consistent basis. And I have come, I don't see this happen a lot, but in terms of like incentive money, sometimes it might be the case that you're setting up the schedule has the receivable set up by control number, you know, by the vehicle. But when the money is being received from the factory, it might be lumped into one control number for that amount. And it might be the case that, like, oh, I got the money but on my statement, but I haven't gotten the detail for it yet. But if you have, so my where I was going with that is if you do have the detail, please go ahead and put that to the control number. I know it's not always possible, but if it is, then, and you don't do it, well, then I might start saying, like, hey, you guys have all this aged items, but it's like, no, they're not aged. They're just sitting in that one control number. We just haven't moved it yet, you know? So it'd be helpful posting it to the specific control number to zero it out. When it comes to the warranty, I know it could be the case that, or it might be the case that you're using an outside company to them. And I recommend giving them a monthly schedule so that they can be putting their notes as to the status of any aged receivables. And so a story I have along with that is the same company. They switched to using an outside warranty company. Their warranty schedule was about 1 to 2 pages long. And this was a very small volume store. However, by 2020, the schedule had ballooned to 20 pages. And so it was the case that the business manager wasn't reaching out to the warranty person to put notes to the schedule. And so it was all these small balances going either debits or credits. You know, they were overpaid or underpaid, and they weren't being reviewed because they were relying on the warranty person to handle it. And so that would be wanting to give them that schedule so they could be making their notes and any adjustments can be made as necessary. Let's see. And then that's just sticking with the incentives. That's 30 days that we typically start following up on. When it comes to the finance reserves, we typically start looking at that. I mean, those should be collected within 30 days in our mind. I know it could take longer. Typically, we start asking questions after 45 days. And then it might be the case that that back in the day that you may have been using like an estimate to determine what the finance reserve was, but it seems like more accurate information is being transmitted. So an accurate amount can be set up, but you still want to be reviewing the schedule to see if you have any of these small differences that need to be written off and so they can be cleared off. I was talking to Chris. He did mention that some of the DMS software, actually you can set a dollar amount and it will clear like, you know, less than a dollar, less than $5, and the system will automatically clear those out for you. Let's see, when it comes to employee receivables, we always want to make sure when we're looking at that schedule, I always make sure that I know there could be a lot of activity, but I look to see that there's current month activity and that a balance is not just sitting there. And I know it might be the case, an employee is on medical leave, and so that's just going to sit there until they come back. When it comes to for a story about the receivable and specifically the body shop, a lack of a schedule review could result in free work performed. It might be the case that the body manager is collecting payment from the customer, but that's not making it to the schedule to clear the item, and or the parts and labor are being put on a different ticket, so the system is not able to match it up. And then you could have the case that the insurance company is not going to pay for something, so the debit would just sit there on the balance. And so you would want to be following up on those with the manager to be getting his comments as to what's going on with those amounts. Anybody have any questions? No? Okay. When it comes to the inventory, I know this is more of a sales side of things, but anything over on new inventory, you want to be units over 120 days, you want to bring that to the attention of the manager. When a vehicle, a unit is sold, the schedule should be reviewed to make sure that there are no lingering amounts that need to be adjusted that need to be recorded with that sale. I know it may be the case that there's a timing difference and the vehicle sold so quickly that that some other invoices weren't able to be posted before that vehicle sold. And then I always review the flooring, the open flooring, to make sure that it's not aged too far beyond the date that the vehicle sold. Because depending on your flooring agreement, you may have 5 days to pay off the flooring or 15 days to pay off. So that's something that we always pay attention to. When it comes to used inventory, I know we typically look over 60 to 90 days. We want to bring that to the manager's attention. I know this market is much different, and that's going to be pretty rare that you have a unit over 60 days. But another thing that could be reviewed on the used car schedule is repairs and looking at excessive repairs. Which could be a mismanagement of resources or even potential fraud. In my mind, it might be the case that the used car manager has some set policies about how much can be added to a car or as like a percentage of its cost. You know, that way you know, if a percentage starts going high, then that might need to be researched to make sure it has proper approval. And then you have the used car write-down, which is a little bit lower than it has been in the last years. And then that, if you do a separate control that just lumps that number in versus writing down specific units. And so what's really helpful, if you want to write down specific units, that's fine. But if you could make it clear in your note, that entry that you're posting, that it is a used car write-down, because it makes it a lot easier for us when we're trying to do an analysis of the write-down, what is the actual total write-down. And then sticking with inventory, when it comes to sublet amounts, those would want to be investigated over 30 days, make sure they're still valid. The labor, the work in process, the labor in process, I know some dealerships have that scheduled, but depending on the volume, it might be better to just use the WIP report in order to make sure that account is okay and there isn't any aged items that need to be researched. So moving to prepaids, if you schedule those out, every prepaid should have its own control number, whether it be insurance, taxes, or construction in progress. And I go so far as, and this is, again, this is something that I recommend that makes our lives easier, is like if it's insurance or if it's taxes, that you do a new control number for a different year, you know. So especially like on an insurance policy, if the premiums are overlapping or the payments are overlapping the years that they cover, it's really helpful to have those as separate control numbers, because then it makes it easier. Okay, that prepaid is now down to zero, and I have my new control number set up and starting the amortization on that one. And then, you know, reviewing the schedule and asking yourself, does it provide a future benefit beyond the current period? And then obviously, if it doesn't, then it should be expensed. I know with that said, managers ask me all the time, like, well, we don't want our income statement to take a hit in 1 month. And I say, okay, that's fine. It just needs to be zero by year end for the tax return. And so if it's February, go ahead and expense it all the way through December, but it does need to be zero by year end. And then just an unrelated topic is that in construction in progress going on, you're going to be posting those amounts to prepaids, but that is something that needs to be reported on the unsecured property tax until the project is completed. So that's just kind of an FYI. If you are using a schedule for your fixed assets, then that I review that schedule to make sure that assets are still depreciating, that still have basis, and that amounts are not being over depreciated. We'll have your
one schedule of sales or surplus.
One account would be your cost, and then the other account on the schedule would be the accumulated depreciation. So just making sure the net of those two numbers is zero or not going negative. If a similar asset is being acquired, then, like, for example, a new lift for the service department, I recommend that you don't add that amount to an already existing control number. I recommend that you put it to a brand new control number. And then with that, it makes it easier to track the depreciation, because when you have multiple assets within one control number, you're going to have your standard entry doing multiple depreciation amounts. And so I think that makes it a little bit harder to keep track of if there's a potential issue. And then it might be the case that you have an asset that as far as you were you knew that asset was already in service and you already started depreciation on it, but then maybe another invoice comes in late, a couple of months late, you've already started depreciation, or something was added to that unit. I recommend again doing a new control number, and it might be the case that I would use that same control number but add a -01 or -02 at the end, so I know that that asset, that additional cost, is associated with that asset, but again makes it easier for me to track the cost and the accumulated depreciation. And then again, this is something that makes it easier for me, for us, is on a control number, having perhaps maybe the first four digits of that control number be the year that I was acquired. That makes it a little bit easier to identify what's new in the current year. Mm-hmm. Okay, switching over to payables and employee withholdings. Theoretically, the payables would all be current. And from an internal control point of view, there would theoretically be a list of approved vendors that the AP clerk would be reviewing and making sure that a vendor is on that list before a payment is being made, in order to prevent any kind of fraud in that sense. And we have seen overpayments on payables because a reconciliation was not done between the, I have vendor invoice, but I should change that to vendor statement, to their month-end statement that they provide, reconciled to what the schedule has. And so if that's not done, it could result in maybe an invoice being paid twice. And then if there's a debit balance, then I would be, and that debit balance starts to age, am I going to be doing business with that vendor in the future at some point, or was that a one-time thing that occurred and I should be requesting a refund for that amount? Moving over to the employee withholding side, that's something that if it's not being reconciled back to what the invoice is from the medical and dental, then there could be the case that that you're overpaying because you have employees who are terminated, but you didn't actually look at the invoice to make sure that that those items are clearing correctly and that any terminated employees are not still on that amount, or on the invoice or on the schedule. And it might be the case that the payroll clerk failed to notify the insurance company that the employee is no longer there. And it could be the case that the company is not going to go back any further than 1 month's premium. And it would have to be done within that coverage period as well. So there are possibly some constraints on trying to get that money back if it turns out that there is an error. With DMV payables, theoretically, there would be no debit balances other than some credits from the DMV and the bundle credits. It could be the case that anything over 30 days could be considered a compliance violation with the DMV. And it could be the case that these DMA or DMV ASF charges that you get, even though they're small dollar amounts, if they're not taken care of, it could result in an infraction on the dealer's DMV license. So you just want to be making sure that you're reviewing for those amounts. And then if it's the case that the controls are constantly having to be adjusted because perhaps maybe the sales department or the F&I department is setting up too much or too little for the DMV, then that might be more of the process needs to be reviewed with them, that they're getting the accurate information in order to record that payable correctly. And so I know it might be the case that, well, it was a busy weekend, and so we didn't have time. We were just estimating to save ourselves some time instead of going to the website, which is fine. But if you're seeing it all the time, then that would indicate that maybe the process is needs to be reviewed. And so if you're having these debit balances, then you would be having to turn around and try to collect from the customer, and you know, good luck with that. One story that that my coworker mentioned was a DMV clerk who had pennies on her schedule, which goes back to the DMV only charging only whole dollars. So they started digging into why there were pennies in these amounts. And so they started asking, and she had left for lunch and never came back. And they estimated that she stole at least $50,000. So had it actually turns out that the business manager was too busy stealing money as well from the bank account. Had that schedule been reviewed, it would have been maybe perhaps discovered that there was an issue with that DMV schedule. And then going back to that business manager, she was identifying those on her reconciliation as ULD, which was unlocated difference. So that's always something that catches our attention. Due bills or WIOs, you know, this is one of my favorites, just like with cash clearing. I know those amounts can age, can get up there in the aging. It might be the case that the VRO is just not being recorded to the payable, and it's instead being recorded to the income statement. And so that would be more of a process needs to be reviewed to ensure that the service department is posting that to the correct item or the correct control number to get it to clear. And then I know it's the case that like if it's like a free oil change, then that offer is only good for up to a year. And then once that year hits, then the manager is reviewing the schedule and writing that off, since that will no longer be something that the company needs to offer that customer anymore. Any debit balances should be reviewed after if the RO is closed. It could indicate work done but not paid for. So then that's something that would want to be looked out for as well. Service contract payables, we always want to those remitted as quickly as possible. We're asking questions after 30 days. And the quick story is that if a customer comes back and wanting work done under the contract, but it hasn't been paid, then it could be on the dealership to pay that amount. And so, you know, my coworker brought up that the good point that, you know, engines like $5,000 is like obviously a lot of money, but if it's an EV battery, well, then that can be over $20,000. So making sure that that schedule is current is vital to making sure that the dealership is not liable for something down the road. Okay, so that was it on the schedules. The next topic was fixed assets. Did anyone want to ask me any questions before I moved on?
There are two questions in the chat.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
That's all right. One of them was, how long do we keep AP debit balances on the books?
Yeah, I don't have a set date for that. That would be more of asking whoever needed that vendor, are we doing anything in the future that you want me to leave this on, or do I need to request a refund? So I don't have a hard date with that one.
Okay. And then the other question was, how long do you let credit sit on the due bill schedule? Customers never come in for their work. That's true.
Yeah, I mean, that's going to be so this is a really good question, and I wish I had a really good answer, but I don't. So, you know, like I said, hopefully you have it in the policy that it's like up to a year that you can come back. I know that's not the case. Okay, so when that happens, the technical answer is that this amount that is this service or this part that's owed to the customer would technically fall under the unclaimed property rules. And so then you have an issue of, well, what do I send to California? Because they paid me for, let's say, a truck bed, but that is not what that cost. But if I were to give him that truck bed, well, my cost is not what I sold it for. So do I mail a truck bed to the Department of to California? That's where I don't really have a good answer for you. That kind of crosses over to an attorney as to what would actually need to be done in that case, you know. So the other answer is it just gets written off. And once it goes away from the schedule, well, then you don't see it anymore. Any other questions?
Anybody else have questions on schedules before he moves on to fixed assets?
I hope I stayed on topic with that and was, you know, in terms of, you know, I did talk about schedules, but if you had any other questions in month end process, you know, I'm definitely more than happy to answer those questions, at least try to answer those questions.
Okay.
So with the fixed asset, so I just wanted to just run through some topics. Just wanted to touch briefly on a fixed asset. You know, if it's going to provide a future benefit beyond a year, then you would want to consider it a fixed asset and depreciate it over its life. I always recommend that a company stay consistent in how it applies its de minimis amount. You know, you got that $2,500 that the IRS allows. If you decided to adopt that, then please be consistent about that. Expense items below that, but then also make sure you capitalize amounts above that. And it could be the case, you know, depending on the volume of the assets, you know, like if it's, I want to not use a laptop, unless it's a really expensive laptop, but some of the equipment, you know, put a serial number on it and put a sticker associated, put a sticker on it with a serial number that you can associate with that piece of equipment to help track it more easily. And, you know, in a perfect world, the different department heads, the managers would be informing the business office when they sell or dispose of an asset. You know, when they comment, I'm living in fantasy land. I know that's not the case. But what I would do is that if I get a new asset, my question would be like, let's say I got a new copier, I got a new lift, I got a new piece of equipment. My question would be, or like a new AC unit, did we dispose of something, and that's why we needed a new one? Something broke and we needed a new one. So that I would be asking that question. I have the recommendation that if you have a schedule, that you have the fixed assets, printing out that schedule, and maybe it's detailed enough that it's by department, that you can give it to that department head. And they can go through and cross out what is no longer here. Again, I'm living in fantasy land. And then, you know, of course, any assets that you can dispose of is going to help lower the unsecured property tax bill. You know, and then also just looking at the fixed assets and just asking yourself, do we have anything from the 90s based on the date acquired? Do we have anything from early 2000s? You know, I'm seeing computers here from 2005. Well, do we have, you know, a couple of years ago, we replaced all the computers. So why would I have an old computer still on the books, you know? And I mentioned schedules for the fixed asset, but like I know for a lot of our clients, we keep the fixed asset detail. So, you know, more than happy to shoot us an email and we can just send you the schedule and then you can turn around and give that to the department to cross off what's no longer there. So that was it about the fixed assets. Anyone have, oh, let's see, trial balance, good tips. Tiffany, did you have any Well, you know, I can make the joke. It should be in balance on the trial balance. So, you know, did you have any specific questions, Tiffany, on the trial balance?
So I was just thinking about good tips on to kind of teach and show from the very beginning to somebody, a possible business manager assistant, on how to kind of start to get wrap her head around it. So I just didn't know if you had any good tips as far as like, okay, how to, because I can explain it to myself, but it's hard to explain it to somebody else.
To somebody who, a non-accountant?
Yeah.
Yeah. In terms of, and in terms of, are you talking about explaining like what the balances represent or?
So why you would be looking at that at month end versus just your financial statement. So when I'm like you're saying, you know, I give my CPA our trial balance and not the fine. I mean, she gets the financial statement too, but
yeah.
Why it is that she wants to see that versus something else and where you can pinpoint like, you know, basically the big differences and stuff like that. I just didn't know if there was something that I'm not explaining properly to get it across a little, you know, easier because they're looking at me like with deer headlights.
So the answer to the question of giving the trial balance versus the financial statement, it might be the case that multiple accounts are mapped to one line item on the financial. So that helps us see the detail more clearly. And so that's why we always need to use the trial balance. In terms of a trial balance isn't going to really, I mean, to be honest, a trial balance really doesn't mean anything in and of itself. You know, it's when it's mapped to the financials that it takes on meaning in terms of the receivables and the inventory and the fixed assets. So I know I'm missing the boat on your question, I think, but did you have anything?
I guess I'm just overthinking it too. You know, I just remember when I was taught, like I was taught in detail, like, okay, this is what this is for. This is, you know, and I'm just kind of, I think over the course of the years, I'm kind of like, okay, trial balance, bye. Like, you know, and, but you guys as our CPAs seem to use it a lot more than on what we do, you know? So,
yeah. Well, I mean, like, yeah, the trial balance is definitely our starting point. And so for example, when we do a tax return for a dealership, I am going to ask, and, you know, and Alin can attest to this, the trial balance is your guys' work and it's your financials at the end of the day. So now you need to defend that balance sheet to me. And so I am going to ask for support for every one of those accounts. Obviously the schedules take care of, you know, 70, 80% of those accounts, but, you know, but I want to see your bank account. Is that expense or is that expense? Is that reconciled? Your factory, is that reconciled? And so the trial balance is a launching point for that because every account on your trial balance should be supported. And, you know, and the trial balance should work. It should be in a way that helps you, however it helps you do your job better. You know, if it might be the case that, you know, I've seen some schedules where it's one account number, but they might be using that account for multiple purposes. And so I'm always of the opinion, well, make things easier on yourself. Don't separate, create a new account, and you can still map that account to that same schedule, but then it'll be a little bit easier to track the information, you know, and you don't kind of create like, okay, well, I'm trying to see what's aging, but if I have two different types here, then I might treat them differently, you know, in terms of what I'm concerned about, what's aged and what's not. So I don't, maybe I'm getting a little bit closer to your question.
No, yeah, that's good. No, that's really good. Yeah, thank you. And then I had one more about fixed assets. So we just put in three of my stores new alignment. Like, I mean, it was a huge job, roofs, all kinds of things. And obviously these will be my fixed assets, but my CPA told me to include the labor. Is that correct?
And so when you say labor of...
I was going to take the actual amount of the fixed asset, and that would, I'd start depreciating that over 20 years. And then, but I would, personally, I wouldn't have included labor because it's technically, it's an expense. It's not a fixed asset. But she said to do the whole invoice.
Okay, the labor from the I'm assuming when you say labor from the company that installed yes. the yeah yes. yeah that would be anything. So the general direction of what gets capitalized is anything that's needed to place that asset into service. So that would also include like freight, any miscellaneous parts or materials that they had to go buy in order to get the piece of equipment to work, and definitely the labor that's okay. involved in that. That's all part of the cost of that all asset. Right. Yeah.
Okay, great.
You wouldn't detail that out in your right. schedule, right? Yeah, right? Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, perfect. Thanks.
Okay. And then Colleen, we have fixed assets from the 80s and 90s that are still here. Can I take them off if they are still here? Aren't they fully depreciated? So does it still cost us tax money to the county? So the answer is, well, I'm not going to tell you what to do, but the answer is if they're still there, then yeah, you would still keep them on your list, on your fixed assets, and you would still pay taxes on them. Not the answer you would want, but yeah, if they're still around, then yes. And then also, okay, computers are now under the 2500 threshold. So can I take the old ones off? So that, again, I'm not, to be honest, I don't really, I tend not to apply new rules retroactively. You know, I know some dealerships, like not just dealerships, but I've seen like literally like pencil sharpeners, staplers, you know, added, you know, and it's like, please, for the love of God, just clean that up. The laptop is a little bit different because that's getting up to a higher dollar amount. So, but like I said, I don't really know if that law can be retroactively applied to get rid of that. Any other questions?
I have one. Yep. So you're saying a piece of equipment is an asset. So when we remodel an office, right? So there's paint, there's new light fixtures, there's new flooring, there's a new bathroom, there's new everything. And it's one office. Is that considered one asset or is like the furniture separate?
So you could dig into the detail of what was done. And so so you're trying to zero in on the items like the desk. Well, that was under $2,500. And yes, I would say you would want to be looking at the items in that case. The desk is not part of this overall remodel of like, let's say you were moving a wall, you know, and rearranging the configuration of the office, you know. The desk is separate from that remodel. You didn't have to buy that desk as a part of that remodel. So if that was under the $2,500, you know, you got a cabinet, some chairs, that kind of stuff, then I would be expensing that. Even though it was all done as part of a remodel, those items would stand separate on their own.
Okay.
And I tend to, at least, you know, with me, I always try to, when it comes to fixed assets, take a little bit more of an aggressive position. Alin, you might say like, well, and I, at some points I might be contradictory, you know, that depends on how aggressive I want to take that position, in terms of if it's can I put it as a repair and a maintenance versus, okay, does it need to be a fixed assets? Because sometimes I can argue with myself whether it's really a repair or maintenance. You know, like for example, a Honda dealership had paved slurried the entire parking lot. And originally I was like, well, you know, Like he did the entire lot. So that would be a fix. It was like $50,000, you know, that should be capitalized, you know. But then I was like, well, no, if you really delve into it a little bit deeper, you know, slurrying is just basically, you know, sealing the cracks in the asphalt. And so it's expected that over the life of that parking lot, you're going to need maintenance, and maintenance slurring could fall under maintenance. It is expected that you're going to have to do that at some point in its life. And so because it's expected, it can be considered a repair or maintenance on that. So what we, you know, I originally said capitalize, but then I changed my mind and said, let's expense it. Okay. And then the last topic is just the retention records. So let me bring over, well, there was a couple of things I just wanted to touch. So the general rule that I believe it was an attorney's office that put this together. They say, you know, everything should be at least 3 years, and that's in relation to tax returns, because tax returns are the years that a return is subject to audit is 3 years. Okay, so that's like kind of like the blanket rule that they throw out of there. And then some more detailed rules, which as I was reading, I was like, oh, I didn't realize that these were actual some rules that they had. So all records should be maintained. And I'm assuming that what they're referring to is physical records need to be maintained for 18 months at the place of business. After 18 months, the records can be moved to an offsite location with the rule that it needs to be accessible or retrieved within 3 business days. And then in terms of electronic files, that will fall under, they can be kept electronically after the 18-month period, assuming it meets these requirements, which, for example, it can't be altered in any way, which, you know, if it's a PDF, it can't be, you can't alter that. It needs to be accessible and retrievable. So, you know, it needs to be on a server or, you know, a server at your place of business or easily accessible through a third party. And that it can be retrieved. It's not just, oh yeah, it's electronically stored, you know, but we can't actually get to it. And then it needs to be legible. So if you're scanning, like for example, repair orders, you know, like with customer signatures or things like that, it needs to be legible. And it needs to have all the pages that if it were a physical document, it would replicate all those pages that are associated with it. You would also need to have a backup of the copy, which, you know, I assume some of the DMSs actually would do that for you. And wherever the file is kept on a server, whether it's kept at your place at the dealership or third party, it needs to have what's called physical and logistical security measures. So in other words, if it's a server room at the dealership, it needs to be behind a locked door or a key code. Logistical is referring to like passwords. So in order to get onto that computer that can access the server, there needs to be a username and a password to get to it. And it references that it's more than okay to have a third party to handle this feature or to retain these electronic copies, but you need to understand at the end of the day, the dealership is ultimately responsible for the document. So if they get, you know, hacked, or if they their documents, the their servers get corrupted, then, you know, pray to God they have a backup, and or you guys have a backup as well. Okay, because ultimately you're responsible for it. Okay, so that was it for that. But then what I wanted to show you is in this document that's 500 pages long, they have this schedule of the records. And so it will go into great detail about the specific type of document, And I don't know if you guys can read it. How many years and when does that date start? And so this is like, this goes on for a few pages. And I think this is whenever an office manager emails me, hey, do you have anything for retention records? This is exactly what I'm giving them. So, which I'm definitely, Alin, I can send this to you. So if you wanted to pass this along to everyone. And then that was it. That was all I had. If you guys had any more questions, I'm more than happy to answer. I like nailed it on the time.
There is one in there from Patty.
Okay, so regarding expenses, what should credit card fees be expensive? So that would be if you have a like a bank account, a bank fee account, then that's where I would put that. If you don't have that, then the default would be the other expense, the miscellaneous expense, if you didn't have a bank fee in your general ledger. Sorry, let me should continue on. What about license fees, business license? That one, should it be, in terms of your first question, that would be taxes and license. You should have that one in your general ledger. Should it be spread between all the departments? I would, you know, if I'm adding more work, then no. but in general, those expenses, the office or the company, the dealership as a whole benefits from the having those licenses. So yeah, I would argue that it could be allocated to the departments. And then I was just going to, let me go back to my contact information. Do we need to break out all the miscellaneous fees for the audits then? Should it be scheduled? So yes, because we're going to, and so you're talking about your other expense, other income, right? I'll even throw other income in there. And so I'll let you finish typing. Were you good, Patty? Okay. So yeah, so like the miscellaneous fees and miscellaneous income. Yes, that is really helpful to have like a spreadsheet and detail out what is sitting in those balances. Like I don't need the credit cards, you know, if you have a credit card account, but the other income and other expenses, every CPA is going to do their own thing. For an audit, for sure, we're going to want to reclass that to perhaps a more appropriate account for financial presentation purposes. Even so, for a tax return, like Alin would have a spreadsheet where she keeps track of that on a monthly basis. The factory money that you would receive for hitting, you know, bonuses or that additional income that you get, that one we will want to reclass. I know the factory doesn't want it going to cost of goods sold, but the for tax return purposes, I do not want to show this huge hundreds of thousands of dollars, $1 million of other income because I do not want to get audited. So, that's why we want to reclass it. In terms of scheduling it, I've never seen it scheduled. I think that might be adding way too much work. You know, because it doesn't need to be perfect. It's really the larger items that are sitting in there that we would want the detail for. And then I was just going to, if you guys just show my contact information. If you have any questions, definitely feel free to give me a call or shoot me an email. Other than that, that's it.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Yep. You're very welcome. Have
any questions before we let him go? Oh, thank you. Okay.
Okay. Thanks, guys. I appreciate your time.
Graham, can I get a copy of this PowerPoint and post it on the website?
Yeah. I'll give you a PDF of it. Would that work?
Yes, perfect. Okay.
And then I'll send you this. Let me show you the title of it. The California New Dealer Association, New Car Dealer Association, 16th edition. Yeah, and then attorneys put this together, and it's 500 pages long, of which, if you look at the table of contents, if you look at the table of contents and then you go to chapter 21, that's where it talks about the retention records, the records retention. So, okay.
All righty.
Okay. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Graham. Thanks, okay. Everybody.
Bye.
Hopefully I'll see you guys all next month. Conference. Woohoo!